Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity back today from the National Review Cruise, tanned, rested, and ready to take on another week, and actually a short week with Thanksgiving just around the corner. Jim, welcome back. Hopefully you had a great time out there.
It is good to be back. You are erroneous in the tanned. Corumbus, I am Irish. You know we don't tan. We burst into flame after 10 minutes of sunlight. So I stayed on the boat the whole time. It was kind of pathetic of me, but got there late and just had a wonderful time cruising with all the folks. So, but I did get questions about the Three Martini Lunch. So to our cruise goer listeners out there, hello.
Excellent. Again. Well, thanks for listening. We love the fact that you're listening and the encouraging words you passed along to Jim. On to today's martinis, Jim, and shock of all shocks, a committee of six Republicans and six Democrats couldn't agree on how to eliminate $1.2 trillion in projected spending increases over the next 10 years. Congratulations on that. But there is some good news on here, and that's that basically the Democrats walked in here with one goal and one goal only, and that was to raise taxes on the rich, and Republicans stood firm. Pat Toomey, National Review favorite, was on Face the Nation yesterday with Bob Schieffer and pretty much laid out point blank why there's not a deal.
On the other side, there was an insistence that we have a $1 trillion tax increase. There was an unwillingness to cut any kind of spending at all unless there was a huge tax increase. Our friend Jim Clyburn, the congressman from South Carolina, said, as recently as last week, said twice, in fact, that the Democrats never coalesced around any plan.
So there you go. Toomey apparently taking heat from the likes of Grover Norquist, which we'll hear about in a minute, and from John Kerry, about the fact that he wanted to close some loopholes and deductions while lowering marginal rates. And so it sounds like Republicans made a number of offers here, Jim, that for the most part were consistent with their values. Some obviously might not be happy with everything that was being offered, but in the end, they didn't cave in on tax increases. We'll see what happens if, in fact, there is no deal and we end up going to these automatic cuts in 2013. But the Democrats, as I said, came in with one goal, and the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans said no, and we have to applaud them for standing up for that.
Yeah, there are two things that we on the right can be happy about, what is generally being seen as a very bad and very ominous bit of news, at least in the establishment organs of the mainstream media. Probably the markets will not be warm and fuzzy about this. Hearing a little bit more discussion about downgrading our national credit rating again, which is obviously not very good news. But having said all that, one, clearly what Democrats wanted to get out of this was a bipartisan veneer to tax increases. They figure, I think quite accurately, if you can get Republicans to vote for tax increases, you will disillusion their base and outrage their base so much that a lot of Republicans may throw up their hands and just walk away from the political process entirely, convinced that there are no good guys anymore, nobody who will, you know, fight for their values. They did not get that. I'm hearing, interestingly, through the grapevine that there were some who wanted to do a plan much worse than Toomey. It's worth noting, you mentioned Grover Norquist. Norquist actually did not mind Toomey's plan kind of as a starting point for negotiations, that if you could draw the Democrats into spending cuts, he kind of saw an interesting article in Politico today, which Norquist is not endorsing the Toomey plan, but he's also not denouncing it, which I think is kind of interesting, since Norquist is considered the Iranian mullah of tax cuts to Democrats. You know. Toomey also, with this proposal, blows up the preferred Democratic narrative in these sorts of circumstances. Oh, we could have had a deal if it wasn't for those stubborn and obstinate Republicans. Oh, they just, you know. No, in this case, I mean, it sounds like there were a lot of folks, including the account in the Post and the account in the Politico, suggested that Clyburn and Patty Murray checked out of this early. Javier Becerra, both these guys were not engaged mentally. At least that's the word there. So I'm not stunned by that. I think that, you know, kind of everybody reverts to type in this. And so there's that particular angle. And I think the other thing is that, look, you and I think a lot of conservatives kind of said, look, you can't put a bunch of lawmakers in a room and solve the funding crisis, the deficit crisis, the entitlement crisis in this country by working out a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Ultimately, this is a big choice, and there is a very big fundamental difference between the economic worldview of a John Kerry and the economic worldview of a Pat Toomey. So you know what? America, 2012, it's going to be time to choose. You cannot get a little bit of this and a little bit of that. That's not going to suffice. And even then, it's interesting that you really couldn't come out with even like a half proposal to come out of this these meetings. And I think the epic failure of the super committee kind of indicates that, look, you cannot simultaneously enact the conservative and liberal visions of government. It's got to be one or the other. It is binary. And you know what, America? It's time to choose. I feel pretty good about our chances in 2012, but I'm sure there'll be many martinis between now and then in which our moods may shift on that.
I'm sure that'll be the case, given where different people line up on this. And we mentioned John Kerry and Grover Norquist. Here's John Kerry talking about the reasons Republicans couldn't agree to the Democratic plan, which we just heard from Pat Toomey didn't exist, but that's neither here nor there right now. Let's hear John Kerry's explanation of why Republicans just couldn't play nice.
The calculation politically has been made by many that they think they're going to win the Senate, win the presidency, and they want to wait until next year and just write their own deal. And the second and most significant block to our doing something right now, tomorrow, is their insistence on the Grover Norquist pledge and extending the Bush tax cuts.
Now, Jim, John Kerry claimed that a bunch of Republicans in the House and Senate have told him that they're just holding the ball till the next election. I don't doubt that some of them think that's a good strategy, but the idea that many of them are just fessing that up to John Kerry strikes me as a little bit far-fetched. And then secondly, I just want to point out that even after more than 10 years, we're still calling these the Bush tax cuts rather than the existing tax rates, which the current Democratic president extended just a year ago.
Yeah, that's a very worthwhile observation about how the taxonomy or the classification of these always still gets associated with Bush. I think that's a good thing myself, but I don't want Obama taking credit for these tax cuts. First of all, you know, John Kerry, who you may have noticed, he served in Vietnam. Greg, I don't know if you know that. He really should mention that sometime. Believes that if you have a strong point, if you emphasize it three times, it becomes more powerful and true. The other thing is that, you know, you saw this example of him saying that, oh, these Republicans were coming up and confessing their sins to John Kerry about how they had these nefarious motives and were not really operating in the national interest and had this nefarious plan to rewrite, you know, everything after starting in January 2013. I remember Bill Clinton saying at some point in his presidency that some Republican had come to him and confessed about how they were determined to not get anything done, and Bill Clinton had, you know, really hadn't raised taxes that much, and he had really been a very reasonable plan, but politics forced him to not be able to say. You know, Democrats are always hearing about these secret confessions of Republicans behind closed doors, and they never name names, and they never quote anyone, and these are never on the record. There's never any secret recordings of this. I can't help but suspect that John Kerry hears what he wants to hear in circumstances like this. And one of the other anecdotes that comes out of this the accounts of the super committee meetings is that particular idea would be out there and they would say, no, we're not going to do that. And John Kerry's perspective was, well, let me talk to you for a solid hour. And by the end of that hour, I will have persuaded you that your entire worldview is wrong and you will see the wisdom of this idea. And he would talk for an hour and they would then say, no, nothing you've said has changed my mind. Nothing you've said has been the least bit persuasive. Well, give me another hour. You know, John Kerry was just utterly convinced that of the magical powers of his own voice, and that of course he could talk Republicans into, you know, adopting tax hikes, et cetera, et cetera. Those of us who've been watching John Kerry for a long time, say back to the days of the Kerry spot, are not the least bit surprised of his overinflated sense of his own abilities. Look at him. Look at the president. That seems a little rather common over there in the Democratic Party, it would seem.
I was just going to say, Jim, it seems like you really miss covering him on a daily basis.
John Kerry, John Corzine. I need more John Edwards. You know, the Democratic Party needs more Johns, and I'll let people interpret that as they like.
Moving on now to martini number three. The Obama administration, obviously, is really the Obama campaign at this point, and they're pretty good at reading polls, and most of those polls suggest that his approval rating is not very high, whether it's overall or on the economy especially, or really on a variety of things. Even his matchups with various Republican presidential candidates, even though he's ahead in some of those head-to-head matchups, he's not at 50%, I don't think, in any of them. So leaving no stone unturned in trying to reach every possible voter for his reelection effort in 2012, the president and his campaign are headed to some unlikely places. Yesterday, Michelle Obama was at the Homestead 400, the final event of the NASCAR season where the Nextel Cup was awarded. And here's the clip of Michelle Obama being part of this group, giving the traditional line of "Gentlemen, start your engines." You notice the crowd's mood before they introduce her and the crowd's mood immediately afterwards.
Please welcome our Grand Marshals, Sergeant Andrew Berry and family, First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, and Dr. Jill Biden, as they deliver the most famous words in motorsports.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
And, you know, Jim, if her last name was Cooper or something, with one of those names where the crowd really likes you but sounds like they're booing you, that would make sense. But it's pretty clear that that's not her element. And something tells me Michelle Obama has probably never even been to or probably even watched a NASCAR race before. On top of that, the White House will soon be hosting a tribute to country music. I'm trying to imagine two different elements that Obama's probably spent less time enjoying.
Well, first of all, maybe they're just bad pronunciation. They're going, Obama, Obama. Not terribly likely. I will give the Obamas a smidgen, a few molecules of credit for this, because if people like you and me are going to mock them for being urban Chicago elitists who like to eat arugula and who have never, you know, who are out of touch with vast swaths of the country, good for her for going to a NASCAR race. But I will also note that, boy, Jill Biden, PhD, she really has to be called doctor all the time, huh? I mean, it's really important that those NASCAR fans know she has a PhD, doesn't it? Isn't it really important, Greg?
Absolutely. You
know, if you're emphasizing your PhD credentials before a NASCAR crowd, something tells me you're not getting the whole point of this reaching out to these voters.
Building street cred.
My attitude would be I tend to refrain from booing the president or first lady myself, but I cannot say I don't understand the sentiment behind the booing. You know, good for Obama for having some country stars and acknowledging that country music exists in the White House. I think it's rather blatant that this starts as the reelection really starts to you know, pick up steam. And I got to tell you, Greg, do you see anybody in America who is very disappointed with President Obama, very disappointed with hope of change? But wait a minute, she went to a NASCAR race and he's got country stars? Well, I'll vote for him now.
Sign me up.
Okay, now I understand. Now, you know, I tend to think these things are – sometimes campaign folks tend to overthink these things and think that they will give him cultural street cred that he just is probably not likely to have. I don't think anybody voted – well – some, you know, numbskull young people may have voted for Obama because he had Jay-Z on his iPod back in 2008. But in the end, I really don't care that much about what kind of music a president listens to, and there are much bigger issues. So good luck with that, Mr. President. I you know, salute you for reaching out to a culture you may have neglected for your first couple of years as president. I wouldn't count on this saving you in your reelection bid in 2012.
Yeah, maybe some Milton Friedman or something on the iPod would be better the next time around, or something that's actually related to the job at hand. Jim, welcome back. Great to have you back, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.